you saying that every Latin mass will be a song of high mass in the universe? I mean,
that's right.
Will there be any Latin masses in the metaverse?
No, but I mean, it's an interesting provocation, because even let's say that in the real world, if we eventually get contact lenses that just alter reality, right? Like augmented reality, right? So you're still going into your run-of-the-mill suburban parish, but it suddenly looks like Shards.
Yeah, you know? It's all green screen. It's all painted green exactly. On the inside, and you walk in.
And to you, it looks like a Gothic cathedral, and to you, it looks like Romanesque, and to me, it looks like a modern church, because that's what I like.
All right.
That's the worst thing ever.
You know,
and the priest is like in the full body green suit, and so right. Like when I see him, he's at Orientum, but when you see him, he's flip facing.
So the altar moves as
sign
well.
Sign me up. No, but
that's right. You just key in your preferences.
Cheers.
To the resurrection of a not quite dead body. So I'll kick us off. The provocation of this episode is the future of Catholic Church architecture. Shana-na.
Scare quotes.
Yeah, scare quotes. So, you know, I'm speaking down to the mic in my chest, kind of to you guys too. For those people who are listening for the first time to the podcast, Rafa and I are architects who spend a lot of our time, most of our time, working for church clients, sometimes at schools, sometimes at churches. So Catholic Church architecture is, in a way, our personal and professional preoccupation that, you know, revolves around our lives and personal and kind of every day, in a way where we get paid to make decisions about churches. So when people talk about wanting beauty and, you know, the kind of popular stuff that's happening right now, what that means beyond just the platitudes or the kind of philosophical trees where you have to decide what color is the paint and what, you know, what is the layout of the pews and like how high is the ceiling and all that sort of stuff, you know, big decisions to small decisions, we do that. So we're, you know, very grateful and fortunate to have projects where we still get to do that sort of work. So for us, the podcast is not just a kind of hypothetical, you know, let's talk about the great churches from Europe and the rest of the world, but it's kind of like so what now, you know? So the question of the future of Catholic Church architecture is like a very current one. We're also in part of the United States that is in a way kind of shielded from the demographic winter that is freezing most of the Northeast, mm-hmm. You know, where the actual freeze would happen.
Right.
Parishes are, you know, merging and shutting down and things like that. In Houston, they're still building and growing and renovating, and you know, a lot of that's because of immigration, not so much because the faith here is like rich and it's not in like Philadelphia or something. So, you know, it's got a particular kind of currency here for us personally. Yeah, that's like for the people that don't know about the podcast, or about who we are,
yep.
Talking about architecture and stuff.
So I think a good place to start would be to maybe just briefly talk about what went wrong or what we see as potentially the problem. Mm. And I actually wanted to start with Ryan on this. So as a layman, what do you think is wrong with churches these days? So with new construction, let's say in the last 30 to 40 years.
I mean, I think that what's wrong with church construction in the last period of time you mentioned is the same thing that's wrong with all the other construction. And all. It's
Do it. Lean in.
Yeah, I knew this was going to be the topic, and one word that kept coming to mind as I was just sort of in my spare moments trying to think about this question is one word that kept coming to mind was patina. Like nice old things, whether it's like a horse saddle or, you know, a tree or a building or any of these things, like time weathers them in a certain way and sort of lends them a kind of
credibility,
a kind of gravitas and a kind of honor that maybe something. And so, and in order to develop a patina, something needs to be able to age well. Mm-hmm. And I think that, I guess, is what I'm getting at. The problem with all current architecture, but church architecture included, is that it's not built to age well. Like, mm-hmm. you know, you see these, you know, here in Houston, you see these white house boxes that are being, you know, they tear down a nice little thing with the ornamental iron and the front porch and everything, or the backyard, and they just build on the whole lot. They build this giant white cube. Mm-hmm. And we live in a town where, like, there's oak pollen and everybody drives everywhere.
Yeah.
And so, like, in 5 years, that white cube is going to look like dog shit. It's going to be it's going to be gray from exhaust, and not in any of the good places, you know? It's not going to age the way a brick building would age.
Yes. Yeah.
It's not going to develop that nice patina. It's just going to look like a dingy old sock. And so everything is made to look good on the page, and it's made to look good the week that it was finished.
Mm-hmm. In the photograph.
And in the photograph, but it's not built to age. It's not built to age well or age gracefully. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is the crux of the issue, both secular and church architecture. Mm-hmm. I mean, like the parish down where I live, I won't say its name, but
protect the innocent.
But you know, it's built.
San suburbia.
Yeah, it's a suburban rite parish, and
San suburbia.
All of the materials should
martyred on the altar of asphalt.
I mean, they're just they're the right materials. They're just put together in the wrong ways. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. like there's wood and there's tile and there's stone. But it's like stone facade, and it's cultured stone, and the wood is laminated into these giant, like, boat shapes that hold up this big domed ceiling. And it's just, it's like I'm sure you come across this a lot being architects, but, like, in the South, Catholic Church architecture is becoming very Protestant in the sense that it's getting away from a cruciform building with, like, a narthex and a nave and an apse and whatever. Yeah. You know, and you know, it's not oriented, it's not pointing east, the tabernacle's not behind the altar, it's over in its own little, you know, space capsule over here.
Uh-huh.
And so, and all of this stuff is just not going to age well.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line.
I mean, and in many ways, they already have not aged well, because some of these things have already been around for 50 years and they look terrible.
Yeah.
Most of the time, you're having to almost rebuild the whole thing.
Yeah, I couldn't. I was trying to find it earlier. I couldn't find it, but I saw something on Twitter like a week or two ago where this sort of architectural aesthete that I follow on there was pointing out this church. I think it was in Basque area of Spain, mm-hmm. where they were using these Roman bricks. They were like big flat rectangular bricks,
okay.
and you could just buy them. I mean, they were always available, and you could just buy them for, like, you know, let's call it a dollar. They don't use a dollar there, but you can just go and buy one for a dollar and take it and give it to the church, and, like, that's how they built
over
it.
Over time, you
like,
built it.
Over time, they built the church with people just contributing bricks here and there, and so the walls are solid brick. It's like it's like a 2-foot-thick solid brick wall, and, I mean, that's going to age like a mountain. It's only 1,000 years from now, you know, barring a meteor strike, it's still going to look good. It's still going to look the way it looked before, only with, like, showing the passage of time in sort of an honest, honorable way instead of, you know, you're never going to have to power wash that thing.
Right. You won't want to.
You won't want to.
What kind of problem do you think that is? If I hear you correctly, there's an issue. Do you think it's a problem of caring, or of not knowing, or of not having you care and you know, but you don't have the political will to make it happen? Like, what kind of illness is it?
I would say it goes deeper, unfortunately, even than architecture, even secular architecture. I mean, it's a problem that we in America, it's a lawyer problem, is what it is. Like, all everything.
It's the lawyers.
It's always a lawyer.
Everything.
Those blood-sucking lawyers.
Yeah, it's lawyer problem and a bureaucrat problem where everything, we have these codes and we have, you know, everything is, you know, I mean, you know more about the codes than I do, obviously, because I know nothing other than they exist and that they hem you in. That you can't do certain things because even though it might work, even though it might be totally safe and fine and whatever, it's not up to code. And so we're not going to be able to get insurance. And if we don't have insurance and some kid falls and breaks his ass, then we're going to be out a bunch of money. Yeah. And it's just this cascading effect where at the, you know, it's like, I don't know. I don't want to sound like Rush Limbaugh and say we need tort reform or whatever, but like it's a societal problem where everything is tied up in following the rules and insurance and liability.
Yeah,
that's very true. So
there's no risk taking anymore.
No, we can't.
Yeah, you're not allowed to take risks because risks, by their very nature, literally by their ontological nature, are risky. Something might happen that's not pleasant, and so like
truism, if there ever was,
we can't have any of that. And so better just to build the safe, nice, ugly thing that 10, 12 years from now is, you know, already going to be falling apart. Like, you know, the church I mentioned, but where I live, like the. For starters, nobody thought through like the confessional placement or like where the line would go. I mean, it's just like they just crammed it in there and the line is stupid. But like people lean in this one, like when they're like second or third in line, they lean in this very specific way, in a way that is already like pushing a hole into this styrofoam, whatever the walls are made of, where they like put the wire down and do the fake stucco, the but plastic, it's really made of Play-Doh or whatever. Yeah. And so they're already like wearing a hole in this wall.
Hey, that's the patina you were calling for.
That doesn't age well. The elbow holes.
Yeah, the kind of patina that moths give to wool clothing. It's,
You're right.
I mean, the parish is 10 years old. And there's like,
Already
the undergirding is showing through in places where it's already starting to crumble. You know.
Yeah, I mean it's disposable architecture, you know, in many ways. But
then why don't we dispose of it and make something better?
That's why we're here. But to follow up on the lawyer thing, I mean, yeah, risk-taking is something that, I mean, the nice story that you said about everyone contributing $1 to get a brick that you can add to the church so that over time the parish builds the, you know, the church, that just can no longer happen in this atmosphere. I mean, one of my favorite things to always bring up, and I'm sure I brought it up before, but that Holy Rosary Parish, built in the 30s, the floor plans say, whenever possible, use parish men for the construction. And I just thought, like, that's amazing. I mean, imagine if, you know, if Regina Caeli or whatever parish was building, you know, their church, and they were like, hey, on the weekends, come help us out. That'd be awesome, you know?
Yeah.
But no church would touch it now because they're all afraid of lawyers. And if the diocese heard word that you were doing it, they would advise you against it because nobody wants to get sued. Yeah. What happens if someone falls off of the top, you know, whatever.
We're going to get sued. And we're already being sued for so many unpleasant things. So a parishioner's broken leg, we shouldn't just add to it. But yeah, same thing in the Irish Channel in New Orleans. Gorgeous churches there. Yeah. One of them is St. Mary's Assumption. And it was built by German peasants. I mean, like, it was hilarious. There was a French church and a Irish church. The French church was Notre Dame de Bon Secours. The Irish church was St. Alphonsus, and the German church was St. Mary's Assumption. And all three of these churches were... St. Alphonsus and St. Mary's Assumption are right across the street from each other. Literally right across the street. Yeah. And Notre Dame was maybe a block away, but all of these people wanted to go to church kind of within their own ethnic identity. And so they instead of having a big, you know, sort of multicultural church, they just built three churches because it was cheap to do it because they were all working class people.
Yeah.
Like there's stories about women on their lunch breaks going down. I mean, they weren't working. I mean, during lunch, they would go down Jefferson Avenue to the dock and put bricks in their aprons, and they would carry them up to the work site. You know, like that's...
Can't do that
anymore. You can't do that now.
Yeah. Interesting.
So,
So how do you diagnose it, Chris? What's your take on that?
If the problem is, in a way, we're kind of looking at what the future of Catholic Church architecture is by looking at the past and kind of trying to project forward.
Trying to understand where we are so we can
think about
the future.
I think that in the future, the only thing that's going to survive is like Gothic buildings. Nothing else will be around. We're just going to like trash them all and then, not even kidding.
Only the
like,
Gothic
that's the only
will
thing
survive.
That's, only the Gothic will survive. That was my first note. First, comma, only Gothic will survive.
You mean actual Gothic?
Yes.
Or do you mean, okay.
Yes.
Like the cathedrals in Europe.
Yeah. I mean, it's a joke, but it's not a joke. And in a way, it's kind of like the things that we invest in that aren't the kind of like crumbling beige, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the things that people are going to really care about. Like when I look back at the books that I have, the things, or maybe not the books, but the things that I want to keep are the things that have the most kind of significance. And it's not even the most expensive things, but it's the things that have the most care put into them. Like if I were to grab something, I would grab my wife and my kids, and then maybe like a thing that I made. Like if I carved a little wood thing, I wouldn't grab my iMac or something that's like the most expensive thing in the house. I'd grab a thing that has the most kind of care put into it. And when I think of, I mean, in a way, the term Gothic is a stand-in for what I see as a kind of a ethic to architecture where every little thing has human touch put into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like everything is, it's very ornate and it's very flowery and it's very mythical in a sense. Like when I think of Rivendell or Lothlorien, I think of Gothic in the sense that it's imbued with life, and so much so that the building itself, the details start springing forth like their actual nature.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that to me, and it's also one of the most expensive things to do because you can't just buy an extruded aluminum thing. You know, it's all bespoke.
Yeah.
So in a way, yeah, maybe that's a way of putting it. If Gothic is a stand-in for bespoke, and bespoke meaning a thing that someone chose to make and, you know, just so, that's probably what's going to survive because that's the thing that people care about. They look and they say, oh, like, I want that. Like, you know, totally forgettable church that has excellent stenciling, all of a sudden everyone's like, beautiful. It's like, well, you didn't do anything to the space. You didn't do anything to the proportions or the height of the windows, but you gave a little touch to it that all of a sudden no one wants to mess with.
Yeah.
I was talking to Father Clark about STM and some other places where we're looking at doing things to the school, and there's a section that's got a mural on it. And every place I've worked at, you probably too, that has any kind of mural, people say, don't touch the mural. And they're never nice. They're always kind of atrocious. But like, it's someone like spent time to make a thing. And in the same way, like that's what people care about. Even though it's not the most expensive thing or the most, you know, design intensive thing or the thing that people spent the most energy on. But it's the thing people care most about. And in some ways, it's probably the least sophisticated. But it's the thing that, you know, has the most of like someone's kind of heart and soul in it.
Yeah.
So I think that's what's going to survive and what we should look to as what will kind of be there in the future. But when I think of, I've been thinking about this for a while, this question, and I know you've intentionally not prepared. You're like, I'm going in and we're just going to ride on it. And you said you've been thinking about it too. At first I was like, I'm not going to do anything. And then after a while, I was like, well, I need to like, as everything has been filtering through this question, and I even posted it on Catholic Creatives and on another kind of social media platform where I said, you know, what's the future of Catholic Church architecture? And the responses were all over the place. Most of them were like, is there a future? Like, do people build today? Like, what is, you know, and it was very... it was generally very negative. Like, it was either like, why are you even asking this question? Kind of like, There were very few direct answers. And when
why do you think that is? Why would people be so pessimistic?
Partly because I think that I'm going to get there after I finish this next thing.
Oh.
The framing question that I asked myself was, what kind of question is it? Like, what's the future of Catholic Church architecture? And I initially phrased it very vague, and people were like, well, what do you mean? Like, and some people like went straight to style. Some people were saying like, well, I think there aren't going to be any churches. So they're thinking like an architectural question of the future is like, do we meet in buildings? Is there a church to meet in? Are we in basements with like little, there's like a dying candle and two like little Byzantine icons, and we're like praying by ourselves, hoping not to die? Like
that was last year. You described it last year.
Would that it were so.
Yeah. Well,
I know that we're still praying.
The Lord is, it's like the end of Father Elijah. We're like the apocalypse is near. Is it a question of style or a question of culture, or a question of politics? Like architecture affects all these things, but the future of Catholic Church architecture can be taken in many different ways.
Yep.
And I think this was the thing pushed a lot in grad school. My program was that everything affects architecture, but they had couched it as everything is political, and in a way that's like the sort of modern position where everything can only ever be politics because that's the end of man. Because when the way I look at it, there is no sort of telos as such. Then all we can be are like kind of warring political bodies trying to strive for like Francis Bacon power. And it's an interesting thing to think about because the way you answer the question, I think, kind of answers the question. Like the frame that you use to think about it kind of gives you the response because it's not always a question of style. Some people say, like when people hear it, they think style and they think like, what the hell are you talking about? Like the church is crumbling. Like I don't care what, is it Byzantine or is it, you know, Baroque or is it classical? Because there are bigger issues. But to answer your question, now that I've kind of gone through my what kind of question is it, I think that the way I answer it, after I went through all these questions myself, is if you ask me what the future of Catholic Church architecture is, there is not a kind of universal response to architecture in the church. In the same way there's a response to like theological issues, right? Like the church can speak about doctrines of the Trinity univocally because there's a single person who can speak on behalf of the church, but architecture is necessarily a kind of one-off localized instantiation of a people and a culture and a politic, and there is no future. Like you could say, what do the Muslims think about X? Like, well, there's no, well, maybe that's not a good one. Protestants. I don't know. What do the Protestants think about X? There is no, like, you know, unified body of Protestants to speak as such. In the same way, there is no single future of Catholic Church architecture.
Are you saying they are legion?
They are legion. No. I'm going to drink some Jameson and move on to the next part.
So, if I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying there is no single answer? Like, there is a multitude of answers to the question?
There is an answer. And I think you could rephrase the question of what is the future of Catholic Church architecture as what is the future of Catholic parishes? And when you think about it in that way, you see that people in Houston will know that the Prince of Peace's and the Regina Chaley's and the St. Anthony's and the St. Teresa's and the, you know, Holy Rosaries of the world are very different places. Mm-hmm. We are ostensibly all under the ministry of the bishop and all of the priests work kind of deputized from him. So the lead pastor of any of these parishes is Cardinal DiNardo, but they are all very different places. And in the same way, I think the architectural response, architecture is downstream from culture, and architecture is also downstream from worship. And if the way people imagine themselves as a kind of community and as a worshiping body is so different from parish to parish, the architecture will necessarily be different. So what's the future of Catholic Church architecture? It's as varied as the future of Catholic parish, like self-identity, I think.
Sure, I think that makes sense. But when the rubber hits the road, mm-hmm. and you get a phone call from a parish, and they say, Chris, I want you to design a church that is completely in the round, that has an altar in the middle, that has TV screens and strobe lights. Mm-hmm. Do you say, yes, because this is your expression of Catholicism? Or do you say,
that sounds like a really cool parish hall, but what about the church?
Yeah. Or do you say, no, that is not in keeping with the timeless tradition of the church. I think we should explore other options.
What's the prison that, like, it's like a sphere?
The Panopticon?
It's like, no, that's a great Panopticon, which is like, thanks for doing the architecture history for me, even though.
Panopticon.
it's a good question. What you have asked is what I want the future of Catholic Church architecture to be.
Well, but that's not That's not what I'm asking. What I'm saying is it acceptable to have a free-for-all, so to speak, in how we design our churches? In other words, is a church in the round just as acceptable as a cruciform church? Is a church that looks like a theater just as acceptable as one that looks like a basilica? Is there a hierarchy of architecture, or are you just saying it totally depends on the parish? I mean, if the parish wants to do something, then
no.
We're good to go, because that's their unique expression of the faith.
We have a disagreement. Let's lean into it. Let me back up to my analogy and see if it kind of has some legs here. Mm-hmm. If the bishop is the lead pastor, the lead liturgist of the diocese, uh-huh. ought he be the prime architect of the diocese? Is he the prime architect? The way that, let's say, Houston works, parishes have a lot of leeway. They still have to go through the chancery, and they have to, you know, make sure that they're not building like six altars because there's one Christ and one sacrifice and one altar. But
I'm glad you brought that up. We're going to come back to that.
In terms of sacrifice,
we're going to come back to that because that's actually a really good point.
There's one Jesus.
No, but see, but that's going to be an interesting point.
Well, but it was one of my things I was thinking of. If the bishop is the lead pastor and he's in charge of, let's say, forming the pastors and like making sure the liturgy is kosher, ought he also? And I'm going to go ahead and say yes. I think he ought to be the lead architect of the diocese, because architecture is in some way forming, it's the cup. If the liturgy is the water, if the cup is, you know, ugly, then the shape of the water is going to like fill that. So, and it may be not as causal as that, but I think that train went off the cliff and I don't know where it ended.
Would that not mean that bishops would need some architectural training? I mean, like, bishops have no, I mean, like,
yes.
You know, they're the lead liturgist and in charge of that sort of thing because they've spent their whole career studying theology and liturgy. Mm-hmm. And
hopefully liturgy.
And, maybe being in the North American College and being in the Vatican and maybe serving in some interesting parishes, like, mm-hmm. I wouldn't imagine they give much thought to architecture.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And I think that it would probably be crazy to imagine someone that's actually capable and ready to hit every problem that comes their way. And in the same way, like, I've heard people talk about how pastors, they're not ready to be CEOs of multi-million dollar corporations, but for medium to large sized parishes, at least in our archdiocese, they are. And the proper thing to do is probably not to run them through business school when they're trying to decide if they want to, like, devote their life to, you know, the promises of the priesthood, to like pray the office and to like, you know, do all these things. So yes, I think it's important. Do they need that early on? Maybe not, but like, that's the thing that every bishop should at least be familiar with, because if they deputize someone, I mean, it's the problem of credentialing in a way, because you can say, oh, you have this degree, okay, you do the thing. But like, you don't really know that the people are good at it. You know that they go to famous schools. You don't know that they're good schools. Is Harvard a good school? Maybe. Is it famous? Yes. And, you know, in the same way, like, there's a credentialing problem with just trusting, but that's not the topic for today.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess my question back to the, you know, the idea of what is the future of church architecture, what does it look like? I mean, I agree that it will have a multiplicity of solutions and they will all look different, but... Mm. I personally think that part of the problem we've had is that we've forgotten who we are. I mean, we have a free-for-all potluck dinner of church architecture where sometimes you walk into a church and you're like, what is this? Yeah. Like, where is the tabernacle? Like, why is this completely in the round? And then you walk into other places and you're like, oh, yeah, this looks like a church. So
I don't want you to what I'm saying as that, like, that I like that that's the future. I think that the way that most bishops currently operate and the degree of freedom that they give individual pastors and parishes means that at least, let's say, for the next two or three decades, unless something crazy happens and people really, really take control, most people in the episcopacy have little enough understanding of how to do it that even if they wanted to micromanage, they probably couldn't do it well. And they probably also have a lot of other stuff on their plate where if I knew all the issues that people actually had to deal with that are running dioceses, they'd probably be like, design it however you want. I don't care. I'm trying to figure out other things.
Yeah, but I guess back to your point about education, do we as architects have an important role to play in educating clients as to how we should build churches? Mm. And I guess I'll back up and just ask this question. Is there a Catholic way to build a church in the way that there is very much a way to build an Eastern Orthodox church? Like an Eastern Orthodox church, there's not a lot of deviation. Like there are very specific parameters that you have to follow, and it produces a specific result. Now, there are different styles you can employ, etc. Is there a comparable way of building a Catholic church, or is that totally not part of our tradition?
I think it was very much a part of our tradition right up until, I don't know, what's the date I'm looking
December
for?
December 4th, 1964.
1965, 66, 67,
December
somewhere
4th,
in there.
The first document.
Yeah, no, I mean, you guys know all the stories about, like, you know, I went through RCIA at the cathedral in Baton Rouge, which is a very old, you know, wedding cake looking church, like white, lots of Gothic ornament and everything. And the if you go inside now, and I happen to love this because it's a very powerful crucifix. The crucifix, giant wooden crucifix, I think it was a Czech sculptor. I forget his name, but we're talking like 25 feet tall, made out of huge logs. This giant rough-hewn crucifix, but it's this crucifix, and then it's hanging on a blank beige brick wall, and then you have the bishop's cathedra. And two lector, you know, a lector and a neck lector and an ambo, and a few other chairs for the kids with the smoke and everything. But like,
the kids with the cigarettes on the side, the smoking.
The thurifer, thank you. But I mean, if you see old pictures of this thing, the altar looked exactly like the outside of the church. It was very, it was marble or fake marble, who knows? But it was white and ornate. And shaped like a giant triangle, you know? Yeah. And there were altar rails. And I mean, the stories you hear about this place, like at a certain point, the rector just came in and they just started hammering that stuff out and throwing it in a dumpster out back. Same with the altar rails. Altar rails went, altar went,
I wish I could be there. And I'm thinking to myself,
like, you want to talk about the past, you want to talk about respect for the past, you want to talk about people contributing to a church, you know? People's parents and grandparents gave money to build that church, to build that altar, to pay for the sculpting, to pay for the materials, and to just come in sort of unilaterally, not talking to anybody. I mean, this was the full-on, like, 93-octane Spirit of Vatican II. These guys just came in, ripped out the altars, ripped out the altar rails.
I'm so far removed from that when I hear stories like this, and it's even more visceral when you see the photos, the before and after, that's the opposite of what you think people would be doing.
Yeah.
That, like, I don't even know how to relate to where they're at, and it makes me think that they must have been so... I mean, Benedict even writes about this, how people were so excited about what was going on that, like, they just look back and they're like, I don't even know.
I'm just wondering what kind of priest gets so excited about Vatican II that he rips the altar out of his church.
but here's the thing, too.
I'm like, I'm so excited, I'm going to throw the tabernacle in the dumpster.
And whitewash murals, whitewash.
But a lot of these documents, they came out with like original little pamphlets and things, and they weren't fully translated until a while later. And most of the like, you know, people, let's say the episcopacy or even lower, couldn't read the Latin when it first came out, so it was a long time before people actually had the final texts. So there was, you know, the whole, you hear about the spirit versus the word letter Vatican II, but that was very concretely, like, there was an actual lag in what people could have possibly
anyway so here again, we're talking about the past, and the question we're talking about is the future, and we spent a lot of time talking about and defining architecture, but we haven't spent any time defining future. Are we talking about the future of church architecture in America, in the world? Are we talking about the future in terms of the next 50 years, in terms of the next 100 years, in terms of the next 1,000 years? I mean, like, the future is a big place.
Yeah,
and so...
It's bigger.
So the idea that, like, I mean, the future of church architecture in, you know, I would imagine the future of church architecture in Europe You know, in, very different in Italy.
As in the past?
Yeah, you know, like you need a church. I'm sure there's several empty ones just laying around that you can go occupy. Yeah,
they have one at every corner.
You know, the future of the church in Africa is probably...
It's very different.
Well, it's different from the future of the church in Italy, but it's I would imagine that the sort of smaller, more charismatic, you know, I would imagine that church arch could, plus also in Africa and a lot of places, I would imagine, I'm not a expert, but I would imagine they don't have the same extremely litigious society that holds them back from taking risks, from trying to make something beautiful or exciting. You know, that we'd have here in the you know, in the developed West and in America, where, you know, I mean, if we're talking about the future of church architecture specifically in America, I don't know necessarily how it can change too far or too fast, just given the facts on the ground as far as everybody being hamstrung by by permits and by license and everything else. And so, but then also in terms of time, I mean, if we're talking the next 100 years, who knows? But I mean, hell, who's to say America
even exists in the
next 100 years? Like, this is still a young country, and I mean, let's face it, we're not making A pluses right now.
That's right, we're not.
So, you know, I think about there was this Orthodox, Russian Orthodox priest. I'm blanking on his name, but I read about him in Andrew Louth's book, Modern Orthodox Thinkers. It's Father John, I think something or something Russian. But he was killed. He was killed on the street in the 90s. People just walked up to him and beat him with a hammer. So you have to think it was some sort of vendetta or something. Wow. But from all accounts, he was a holy priest and a smart guy and everything. Word. And there's a quote that I remember from him where he talks about how, like, people think because we're, you know, in the year of our Lord 2000 or in the year of our Lord 1990, whatever, when he was saying this, you know, people think that, like, Christianity is sort of over and done with, that the story has been told and we're kind of living in the afterglow. And he's like, that's ridiculous. Like, how could you possibly assume that, like, as long as time is still going, the story is still going. And the story, I'm paraphrasing him wildly now because I can't, but the gist of it was, the idea is preposterous that, like, because we're 2,000 years from when Christ walked the earth, somehow... You know, we had the apostolic age, and then we had sort of the medieval period, and then the Renaissance, and now industrialism, and that it's just that the Christian story has sort of ceased, and we're all just, the book is closed, and now we're all just living sort of in the presence of this completed story, and we don't know what to do because the story is over, and where's our place in a story that's already been completed?
That's modern Judaism.
And he talks about how, like, no, like, Christianity is still very much happening right now and spreading out into the future ahead of us. And so, like, you know, do something with it. Like, make something of it. Don't just exist in it. Don't just... you know, learn the rules and then follow the rules and then live follow the rules on Sunday or on whatever day you go to church and then the rest of the time just be a good citizen or whatever. You know, like, the story of Christianity is far from over. And so act that way. And so I think about that in terms of architecture. Like, I mean, all of the sort of marquee... top shelf architecture now, all the really weird shit, you know, that's done by really famous top tier architects, you know, like Crystal Bridges Museum in Arkansas, stuff like that. Like, why shouldn't everyone who's in charge of building a church, I don't mean architects, I mean the people, you know, form follows funding, right? Episode one. Yeah. Like,
episode one, form follows funding. Patreon.com/ smash that like button. PayPal, Venmo. Come on, you can do it, people. Let's go.
So, like, I'm not specifically talking about architects. I mean the people who are actually, you know, paying the bills and making the churches and therefore have some say in it. Like, why shouldn't everybody in that position be shooting for something amazing? Something, because, and I, granted, there are ample opportunities to point out where that's gone bad. You got the egg, the space egg or whatever, and is that Los Angeles?
In California, yeah.
In Oakland, I think. Yeah, I mean, like...
The SOM thing or what?
Yeah,
a lot of architectural innovations are as bad as their liturgical innovation counterparts, you know, so... Mm-hmm. But that's the risk, you know? That's the somebody took a risk on that space egg cathedral.
They did.
And, you know, I don't know. Who's to say? Who's to say how that's going to age?
Who are we to judge?
Who indeed are we to judge? And also, I've only seen that in photographs. Have you set foot in that church?
I have not.
Have you set foot in that church?
Negative.
I've not set foot in that church. Maybe inside the actual building, it works somehow. I don't know. You see pictures of it, and you're like, damn, that's an ugly church.
That's like a water refinery plant.
Yeah. You're like, you know, or you, or the, was it Corbusier that made the church in France that looks like a...
Ronchamp.
Looks like a Smurf like on a acid built that thing.
Yeah.
And
Smurf on acid.
I'm just like...
Yeah.
Wait, there's like three of them. Which one are you talking about?
Ronchamp.
Oh, Ronchamp. I was like, there's more than three Smurfs. What are you talking about? I can name like 10 of them.
Yeah.
But, so, yeah. But, I mean, that's the risk that we're talking about. You know, you talk about taking a risk, like... You're not always going to, you know, when you're going to pick up the spare, like, a lot of times you're not going to get it, you know?
Yeah.
But that's the risk. That's the risk of, and so, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe the sort of, like, I don't know. Would you call yourself aesthetes? Like, maybe the people who are down with, like, think they know what's what with church art, church architecture, you know, like me, need to be more forgiving of the times when somebody tried something crazy and then laid an egg, you know, because at least they were trying. So at least they weren't just picking options out of a
out of a catalog,
out of some corporate contractor's catalog, and being like, "What do you think of this cultured stone facade? That would look good right behind our resurrection crucifix." You know,
yeah, I would definitely rather people fail. And cut, like, perform errors of ambition rather than errors of fear, you know. And the error of fear would be the, you know, we need to build at the dollar per square foot that we know is reasonable for our area, and you optimize a spreadsheet before you ever look at anything or talk about, like, the liturgy that you want your parish to have or anything like that, as opposed to taking risks, which sometimes flop, but, you know, there are a couple kind of risks you can take. One of them is the risk of just, like, not trying. The other is, like, trying too much and kind of falling on your face as you're running really hard instead of just, like, never actually running at all because you're afraid of upsetting the donor base, which is going away very quickly.
Yeah.
You miss 100% of the shots that you don't take.
My poster on the wall.
Michael Scott.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
One of the things that I had...
And the subtext to that is that you miss 50% of the shots you do take.
You do take.
Which is how you end up with some bad-looking churches. 50.
Hey, if you're shooting 50-50, that's not bad.
Yeah, that's not bad. Unfortunately, I don't think we are shooting 50-50. I think it's a little less than that these days. But, but I think you bring up a great point, which is, what does the future church architecture look like? Is it closer to the historic past of the church, or is it something truly different and new? What do you think, Chris?
I have to hope that it's something new.
Why is that? What's wrong with the
and is
the
it
great models?
Is
of
it
the past?
Bigger or is it smaller?
Like actual spaces?
Yeah,
I think it's definitely bigger.
Is it 6,000 family megachurch?
Unfortunately, I think
or is it,
unless we have a vocation boom?
I think it's
chapels, small oratories where you can
for the next, let's say, 15 or 20 years, it's fewer churches that are bigger. Just like, so Houston has to have, let's say, as a single example, data point of one. So, you know, what's the story? Anecdote does not equal data when it's one anecdote. Houston has to have, I was talking to Father Clark yesterday, actually. We need 40 new seminarians every year to meet the normal attrition rate to ordain 13 men a year for the next 15 years to break even.
Wow.
And we are at less than half that. So if you just extrapolate the data and say, no better, no worse, we're just kind of shooting par for the course now for the next 20 years or 15 years, every parish will have half as many priests as it has now, which means...
That's terrible.
Most parishes have two, so they're going to have one. Parishes with one priest, that one priest will then serve two or three different parishes. Mega parishes with four will have two, and will have half a bishop. but it means basically that the pastors will be taxed at 200% or more of what they're at now. And I can only imagine that what that means is, even in Houston, that it, you know, just to be efficient with your pastor's time, we're at least going to do what we're doing now, which is no new buildings that are smaller than 1,500 seats. And we're getting very close to the size of the co-cathedral, which is like the most important building in the parish or in the diocese. So I think they'll get bigger. They'll either stay where they're at now or they'll get bigger for the next decade or two. And then at that point, who knows? Like, the demographic winter comes, we're all crashed, we sell everything to like bars, and they're just like, you know,
yeah, but
restaurants and things.
But bars and skate parks, they only like the nice, cool old churches.
That's right. True.
They're not going to...
Not the barns that we have now.
Yeah, they're not going to want to buy my Suburban Right Hootenanny down in...
Suburban Right Hootenanny. Season 2, Episode 1. Suburban Right Hootenanny. The future? Question mark?
Our airport terminals.
Yeah. I mean, this line that I picked up from... there's this website and podcast called Farnham Street, which is basically like... it's a collection of just like... mental models is what they call it. Mm. They interview people about all kinds of stuff, finance and like business and all sorts of things. There was an episode where they talked about this idea, and I've kind of kept this structure and applied it to many of the things, and I think it's really useful, where you say X is a lagging measure of Y. And it's similar to the structure where you're talking about earlier, Rafa, about how, earlier meaning like episodes back, about how architecture is downstream of culture. And the rephrasing I've done for this episode is that architecture is a lagging measure of our liturgical habits or our worship habits.
Health, I would actually
say. Liturgical health, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the structure is basically X is a measure of Y habits. So your current, your bank account is a lagging measure of your spending habits. Your prayer life is a lagging measure of your prayer habits. Your kids, you know, report card is a lagging measure of their study habits. So applied this way, and I think it's interesting thinking of things as, you know, you're spending time earning this in the past so that now you can like see where it's at, that our architecture, our buildings, are a lagging measure since the 60s or beyond of our liturgical health. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think that's a quippy little one-liner.
Yeah, no, I like that. I liked it a lot. One thing that, you know, we don't want to spend the whole episode on the past, but I do think it's helpful to some extent.
It's going to be a four-hour Joe Rogan, man.
You were talking about how it's hard to understand how, like, someone could come in and rip out all this beautiful stuff, you know. But I feel like it's really important that we try to understand because...
Yeah, I agree.
Number one, just to try to... I guess give the reformers the benefit of the doubt and be like, okay, what were they seeing that we're not seeing here? And then how do we try to understand what they were trying to do? And do we continue that program or do we change course? You know, because it seems like the general spirit of our age is to return to some more traditional, you know, type of things.
Yeah.
But clearly, that's not what they were into at the time.
Yeah, I like the word reformers you used, because that's what they called the Protestants in whatever 1600s England when they dissolved the monasteries and basically wholesale squandered their entire like national heritage.
Yeah.
You know, so...
Because what's interesting...
What term?
Reformers. Reformers. That's reformers. Yeah, they were
they were the Protestant reformers.
The Lutherans were the reformers who went in and burned all the monastic libraries in England and dispersed all their goods and ripped down the churches and
So this, I found this book that I was on my bookshelf I hadn't read before. It was called The Liturgical Environment: What the Documents Say. And I was like, okay, what documents, you know? And you tell me, Chris, if you think these documents are not, like if you were to design a church, would you refer to these documents
okay.
in order to try to guide the design?
All right.
Tell me if these are heretical
I'm ready.
Documents.
Okay, I'm thinking.
Number one, rite of the dedication of a church and altar.
Ding, 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 ding.
The general instruction of the Roman Missal.
No, okay, yes.
And built of living stones, art, architecture, and worship.
Maybe.
That was put out by the bishops' conference, those guidelines for architecture. Okay.
Yeah.
So this book is not based on like crazy, and obviously the other document that this book is based on is Sacrosanctum Concilium, you know, the sacred constitution of the liturgy from the Second Vatican Council. So not documents that are like crazy or made up by people in the 70s that were just crazy. Mm-hmm. So again, these you would consider to be good documents to refer to when you're designing a church.
The base documents, like the most baseline documents.
The most baseline documents, yeah. Right?
Outside of like scripture itself.
So yes. In reading this book, and granted I haven't read the whole thing, but I've read about half of it, and what the takeaway here...
It's like, the bookmark's not halfway there.
That's not representative of where I am.
Okay.
Guys. For those not watching on
that's not representative
the YouTubes, the bookmark is not halfway through.
I got the gist, okay?
Mm-hmm. You round it up.
So the introduction of the book, which is all I've read. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
Uses over and over again active participation as the most important principle when thinking about not only liturgical reform, but church design.
Hmm.
And, you know, when you look at the Second Vatican Council documents, I mean, it does say that above all else, the full conscious active participation of the faithful in the liturgy is the principle upon which this is built.
Hmm.
Right? So, based on that, what is the architecture of active participation?
Yeah, leave the altar alone. Give everybody trampolines.
If,
what are you going
to do? If someone...
Trampoline.
If someone were to ask you, Chris, I want you to design me a church, an active participation church, what does it look like?
It's a church where everyone chants during the Mass.
Okay.
And a joke, not joke.
What is the shape of that church?
It's a basilica church. It's a long rectangle, a very, very long rectangle with very high proportions. Kind of joking, kind of not joking. I was reading an article where, I want to say it was probably John Trujillo, but he was writing about the history of this term active participation, like not the English, but like the Latin of it, and how prior to the Second Vatican Council, that phrase was used in a number of other documents, and it was used almost exclusively to refer to the idea that the congregation would sing the chants in the Mass. So active participation, up until that point, wasn't a brand new term, and there was this idea that people, the congregation was meant to be participating, but it was always referred to, almost synonymously, as this idea that people should be chanting in the Mass.
Mm-hmm.
So if I take that and just say the Church Fathers knew what was written before, this may be totally wrong, but the article basically made the point very clear, then I would say that like a church that has full active conscious participation is one in which the people are participating in the liturgy and singing it and chanting. So in the way I think of like chant as being the most sort of chorally rich is one in which there's like a 7-second reverberation rate and all of the services...
Can't hear the spoken word.
But you can't hear the spoken word. All of the services are super hard. The proportions are like 2-to-1 at least with the height. And, like, if you're in the back row, you could never see the pastor celebrating Mass because you're so far away.
And no kneelers. You put your knees on the cold,
hard stone.
On the cold, hard stones.
No pews.
And right. That, these are a Protestant invention.
Zero
that
pews.
Right there is your active participation. You actively participate in putting your knees on the hard floor.
Hard calluses.
Floor. That's right.
Well, see ya.
This author disagrees with you.
Oh. What,
so
what's his name?
What
and why
the
is he
documents
wrong?
Say. So, according to him,
is it Dennis McNamara?
And
yeah.
He
does he have an SJ after his name?
He cites all the documents that you would read when referencing church architecture.
Okay.
He says that the cruciform plan is a hindrance to active participation.
Is a hindrance?
Because you are so far away.
I didn't say cruciform.
Because you're so far away from the action.
I see.
You're just staring at the back of the head of the person in front of you. There's no way you can actively participate.
Cruciform is a hindrance or...
Cruciform. Specifically cruciform.
Okay.
Basilica, he's okay with because there are no pews and people can walk around and mill around.
Yeah, yeah.
In his conception of church architecture. He thinks the most ideal floor plan for a church is stadium seating.
Stadium seating.
So you have the altar in the middle and kind of like a boat shape around.
We do disagree.
I'll go in one better. The ideal church layout is the crypt of a Benedictine monastery where there are side altars all the way down, and there are 12 different masses going on, and you can sit right. You can
participate in all kinds of.
You can even serve. You can go right up and serve at the low mass.
Absolutely.
And that's as active as you get. Boy, it's at 5 o'clock in the morning.
I know. So, the reasoning he gives for that being the active participation is that critical to active participation is visibility of what is happening. Mm. But not only visibility of the altar, visibility of each other. Because we are all acting out the liturgy when we go to Mass.
Yeah, I totally disagree with that.
Mark,
I want to arm wrestle
Mark
him.
Mark Boyer.
If I arm wrestle him and beat him, he's done.
And again, based on all the documents that you would say are fine.
Yeah, yeah.
So you ask, how did the altar rails get torn out? How did the statues get thrown out of the churches? It's because of justification through this active participation.
This is not a stadium seating.
That isn't.
On the cover of the book.
Right. It's not. No. Through the justification of active participation, this understanding of active participation, and then noble simplicity. Mm. This idea that...
Your fellow man is all the saint statues you need.
That's right. And this idea that the rites of the church and the church itself should have a noble simplicity. It should be simple. It should be easy to understand. Mm. And it should be very clear what's happening. Mm. Using those big picture ideas is how people felt the need to rip out the altar rail, etc. Because they felt that all of those things, altar rails, multiple altars, statues, etc., were impediments to being able to fully participate in the liturgy. They were distractions.
Static.
That's how we got to where we got.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder though, like what the, in the very beginning of the documents of Vatican II, in the introduction to the constitutions, the term that's used a number of times is basically like vitality. The whole reason for all of it is to breathe life back into, vitas, to breathe life back into the liturgy. And
it seems it was dead.
That's exactly what I'm getting at. There's an assumption that there's something that's like not fully life-giving about the liturgy as it was. Yeah. It also talks about how it's like it's very tailored to their time. And I'm kind of wondering, like, if we're 60 years hence, are we like, is it the same project? If the documents are published in the early 60s and we're in the 20s, then like we're getting close to like being maybe like on the tail end of that. And like, how long will we need to be enacting the project of Vatican II? Meaning like if it's of its time, maybe its time was like waning in the 90s and now we have a new thing. I mean, maybe not.
It's a good question.
It's just like an open question that like isn't one I want to really answer right now. But if it's very focused on the current issues, the issues in the 60s may not be the same issues as today. That being said, I personal experience, again, anecdote does not equal data, but the times where I have been and my kids have been in, three kids ages like 3 to 9 have been in churches that have been in the round, literally stadium seating, like it's a contact lens with the altar in the bottom, right. And we're kind of in this little dish. It has been slightly a hindrance at best, aggressively destructive to the worship at worst, and it's not particularly helpful to have that personally for me, because it's just like there's so much else that's distracting. Like, it's not like I'm participating in the mass. It's like I look at someone across the way. All of us are totally like blitzed out by all the screens we use and all the technology we use. The last thing we need is to have everything on at all times. Like, we need the kind of distance from what's going on. So personally, Mr. Mark G. Boyer, I, you know, respectfully disagree with the, like, if what you're saying is what he actually means, which is that slight stadium seating is what he thinks is best. That's not been my personal experience.
Yeah, but yet, I think he represents a sizable part of the Catholic Church. I mean, I don't think he represents a minority position.
Yeah. I've heard it by any means. I've heard people talk about doing a cruciform.
The minority position is sitting around this table.
Yeah, right?
we are the minority report. No, I mean, I definitely.
So, as a church architect, like, how do we wrestle with that? Like, how do we go forward? As you think about, like, you know, the future churches that, God willing, we will design. Uh-huh. What do you base your design on? Like, what are the foundational documents or ideas that you base your design on?
It backs up into questions of how a project ought to work. And if you're in schematic design already, you already have your building committee. You already have people ready to go. Your pastor's there. Your influencers are already in place. Mm-hmm. And they're not in a place where they're looking to continue to form themselves. They're looking to execute on a project.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're at that point, then the ship is almost gone. It's kind of like saying, let's start talking about the house you want to build and say, well, let's start researching what it means to live in a house with a domestic. You're like, no, I need a house. Like, we need to move into a thing. Like, I know the bedrooms I want. I know how much money I want to spend. I know the color of the front door. People are already ready to build the daggum thing. And you're kind of, I mean, and you probably have experienced something similar too. People really quickly get to the point where they're like, just show me the building. Let's do the design. And honestly, if you get to that point in the project, to answer your question directly, it's probably too late. Just speaking real practically. If you are listening to this and you are a pastor or you are in any way involved in a construction project, and you think it's ever going to happen, start now. Start reading books. Start finding people that you want to learn from. Keep on listening to this podcast. Somehow get involved with things. Because by the time that you get to the point where people actually are trying to fundraise and build and design, there's no time to take the time to form yourself. Because what I hear you saying is, like, how do you deal with it whenever my opinions are different from, let's say, the consensus of the church?
What I'm trying to hopefully get to through this conversation and hopefully more conversations is get us out of the realm of opinion. In other words, is there a Catholic way to build that we can articulate, that we can rely on and depend on?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I mean, church architecture has only been the realm of opinion for the last 40 or 50 years. Mm-hmm. It's whatever the priest wants, mm-hmm. Whatever the committee decides. But do we not have some sense of objectivity about what a church should be? Should we not have some, maybe the answer is no, but
yeah.
No. That's what I'm trying to get to is there some sort of objectivity to what we're talking about? Or is it truly all in the eye of the beholder?
Yes and no. Beauty is a thing that I think you can objectively talk about in objective terms. We don't have a prescriptive definition of how churches have to look and to some degree function, at least in like the Western Catholic Church. But I mean, honestly, I kind of long for something of the clarity that the Orthodox have, where there's such, let's say, like, narrow design scope, or like the options are reduced. Inside of that, you can still do many, many things. It's kind of like you have a number line, and if you cut off the two ends, there's an infinite number of points mm-hmm. inside of those two numbers. Mm-hmm. Even if they're infinitely tight, there's still an infinite number inside of them. Design is a kind of metaphorical parallel where as soon as you set up boundaries, there's still an infinite number of points on that line where you can like tool your building in some way. So I wouldn't at all think that if you set boundaries, then that reduces what you can do. In a way, it may freeze you, like Captain Rye style. But speaking directly to your question, is there a specific thing that the church understands as like being church architecture, Catholic church architecture. I don't know what it is, but I parallel it to the way the church views chant. And in recent reading and studying and like practicing, you know, chant with Alexis Katarna in her summer chant school here in Houston.
Shout out,
Alexis. Oh, video. Shout out. we have a video there. It's the first time I noticed it was on. The way that she was telling us, kind of instructing us, that the Church views chant is that it is objectively the best, the most fitting or the most beautiful, I forget the exact terminology, music for liturgy. And
I believe the words you're looking for are pride of place. Pride of place. Gregorian chant should have pride
That's
of
right.
place.
That's right.
Yes, sir.
And other music is fitting to the degree to which it conforms to Gregorian chant. Not just that chant has pride of place, but that everything else is measured to that. So I think that there has to be something parallel to architecture where there is a kind of Gregorian chant architecture where this has pride of place and everything else can be measured to it, and the degree to which it conforms is the degree to which it's useful. And in the Vatican II documents, it talks about how Gregorian chant is the first one that's listed on the types of music. And at the very end, it says, and popular music. And it's like almost a postscript. But it's the last one in the list. And I think that the hierarchy is important.
It's the last thing they heard. So they were like, sweet, popular music.
Yeah, it's the death knell. It's like, no!
Well, it's like, I was just rereading one of the documents where it talks about like, law of the church remaining in place, Latin is to be preserved.
Yeah.
But then the immediately next line says, but if you feel like the vernacular is helpful in some cases, then it is up to the bishop to decide if, you know, blah, blah, right. blah.
Yeah.
So the bishops were like, yeah, we're going
to
do
the
vernacular.
If the faithful in certain places desire to have the Mass in the vernacular, it should be made available. And they read that and be like, sweet, Latin in the toilet, vernacular for every Mass across the globe all the time.
Yeah,
I mean,
in fact, now we're at the point where Latin is being vilified.
Yes, indeed.
Yes. So I guess maybe speaking real practically to that, acoustically, if Gregorian chant is the thing that needs to be given pride of place, there are architectural implications for that. Because Gregorian chant has needs for, maybe not needs, but there are ways in which you can make chant better heard by the people. Mm-hmm. So if the architecture is the largest and sort of preeminent musical instrument for forming the sound of the liturgy, the music of the liturgy, then for that reason only, there ought to be a way in which we could, you can like tune the hardness of instruments and the size and shape is kind of this black box of mystery when it comes to acoustics, but that should be one way in which there's a kind of architectural project for the future, which is to see to it that Gregorian chant is, you know, lifted up and given its place of pride among other types of music. You know, there's like a funeral pyre outside with like the drum kit and stuff like that.
So. Yeah, I mean, it's the thing is, we were just talking about this, what you just mentioned. I mean, Gregorian chant is sung in the vast minority of churches. I think, you know, we were talking about altar rails or communion rails. How many churches in the diocese have communion rails? I think you can count them on one hand.
Yeah,
They also happen to coincide with the churches that also sing Gregorian chant. So,
and the ones that were built in the 50s. Yeah.
So it's just, it's interesting because there does seem to be vast disagreement as to what the nature of the liturgy should be. And therefore the nature of church building. Yeah. And so as you try to define what is the future of church architecture, I mean, it seems like we need to first agree on what the Mass is. or what the Mass should be like.
I mean, if the question is what the future of church architecture is, that's different from what it ought to be. And I know that we're concerned with what it ought to be. I think the reality of what it is it's going to continue to be as disparate as it is now, maybe even more so. But the more interesting question is, I think, what you're getting at, which is not what are all the possible bad versions of Netflix movies, but like, what's the only movie you should care about? Like, what's the actual one that you should spend time thinking about and investing in happening again and again and again. Ryan, you're looking at me like a madman.
I'm thinking that's as good a segue as I'm probably going to get to take another sort of like hard turn into the weeds.
Do it.
Of like the far future, like the future, yeah. You know, more, I mean, who knows? I say 100 years, could be 60 years, could be 50 years,
yeah.
You know, because the way, I mean, everything culturally and digitally and technologically is accelerating. Mm. And so like, you know, let's for the sake of argument say in the range of 50 to 100 years from now, are you guys familiar with the concept of the metaverse?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Facebook wants to be seen. Have you heard since this article?
What?
I'm going to interrupt you for a second.
The Facebook church.
Zuckerberg came out in a recent Verge article saying that in five years, he wants Facebook to be, and it was very intentionally phrased this way, he wants Facebook to be seen as a company that is primarily a metaverse company, not a social media company. In five years is like that.
Yeah, totally. So what he's saying is view us like that right now, from now on.
Yes.
Yeah. And so if you're familiar with the concept of the metaverse, and you're familiar with the concept of like VR or AR, augmented reality or virtual reality, and you're familiar with maybe the film Ready Player One.
Mm-hmm.
Or the book.
Where everybody lives in shipping containers. Ready Player One. But then mm-hmm. they...
Not everyone, just the poor folk.
Jack into the metaverse, and that's their real life, quote unquote.
Yeah. Yeah,
I can do square quotes because I'm on video.
Yeah.
I think that's an interesting... There are obviously problems associated with that because the... There are obviously problems associated with that because the Mass and the sacraments are meant to be places where the grace of the church is made manifest in things that you can touch, right? In water, in oil, in bread. And so the idea of it going digital. But I mean, like, how many Catholics already don't believe in the real presence? How many Catholics
70%.
Don't go to Mass anyway? How many Catholics don't... I mean, if you want to get... nitty-gritty, like how many Catholics don't even understand the concept of like the sacraments as the grace being made manifest in a physical form? I mean, they're just like,
yeah.
How many Catholics didn't understand the question in the first place?
And so, well, and so what I'm getting at is it would be hard to imagine, maybe not that hard to imagine, I don't know. It seems to me that it would be hard to imagine the actual church, a diocese or a bishop's conference or whatever, sanctioning a sort of Catholic church within the metaverse, mm-hmm. simply because the way the sacraments are viewed, or not are viewed, the way the sacraments are built, the way the sacraments exist and are interacted with is physically. But that doesn't, I mean, that doesn't stop it from happening. That doesn't stop it. I mean, like...
There will be churches that celebrate liturgies in the metaverse.
Okay.
I feel like
so,
that already is.
So there to me, is a very interesting idea where all of a sudden form doesn't necessarily follow funding.
Right.
Form follows whatever you can do.
Yeah.
And I mean, can you, like, imagine... You know, people in their goggles and their suits and whatever, and like they're all in their goggles looking at chant books and like people in different states all singing in the same scola in a service in this digital church in the metaverse.
In a digital shards cathedral.
And you can build however you want. You don't have to worry about liability. You don't have to worry about permits. Literally, the sky is the limit of your imagination. You'd have to work out the unfortunate, you know, like I've always wondered from, I mean, I'm a convert, obviously. I've only been Catholic for, I guess at this point, about 11, 12 years. In the beginning, I was always, indignant's too strong a word, but I was always like, why can't you go to confession over the phone? Like confession is...
Yeah.
It's a beautiful sacrament that I love and take advantage of frequently, but it's a pain in the ass to like drive wherever you're going, stand in line. Sometimes you got a priest who goes chop, 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 but sometimes you got a priest who talks to the old lady for 15 minutes, right? And then you stand in line for 30 minutes, and then the priest comes out and tells you, sorry, I have to start Mass now.
Yep.
And so you're like, well, shit. And so like, why is there not a confession hotline? where there is a priest in good standing, you a Catholic in good standing, call him, tell him your sins, he absolves you. I mean, like, there's, it's proximity. I've asked several priests about this, and they've, I mean, it's about...
And they're concealed and confessional and recording.
It's about proximity of being, you know, within earshot of another human being is like the form of this, or the, is it the form? There's a form and a...
Form and matter.
Form and matter. Is it the form or the matter? I forget. Either way, one of those is like you being in vocal proximity of another human being. Like that is the substance of that.
Prerequisite.
That is the substance of that sacrament. And so, you know, same obviously, like you wouldn't be able to take like a digital Eucharist. But, I mean, hell, I don't know about you guys. I just finished going to streaming mass for like 10 months
the digital Eucharist
last year.
The spiritual communion.
The spiritual communion.
Yeah. Which is a real thing.
It absolutely is a real thing.
And if anything, that's what COVID allowed us to remember.
Yeah. I'd never even heard of a spiritual communion before COVID.
Yeah.
And, yeah. Like I said, I'm a convert. Yeah. And so I found that whole thing fascinating. And so, I mean, I'm envisioning like, maybe not even 50 years, maybe 25 years
Ready
in the future.
Player one.
You have a Catholic church, a Catholic parish in the metaverse. You have various Catholic parishes in the metaverse, same as in the real world. You got the tratty one, you got this, you got that. And you can go and you can sing in the Scola and you can take spiritual communion from the priest doing the... And I mean, you can make the church however you want. Mm-hmm. And so I guess an interesting question is, since we're talking about the future of Catholic Church architecture and pessimistic view is like, maybe that's sort of the way society is going where like, yeah. I mean, to hear the metaverse bulls talk about it, like the metaverse is going to be the society of the future. It's where people are going to hang out and do things and work and everything else.
It's the next internet. So if you imagine like, what the church said about the
internet. But it's the internet that you're inside of.
Right.
You know?
And this is the world. But if you imagine by analogy, someone talking about the internet in like 84, if they said like, well, the church can't be online because we're a sacramental church. We have to be there in person. Imagine there being no church efforts, evangelistic or anything, online today. Mm-hmm. You'd be like, well, clearly that's not the case. So if you imagine the same sort of jump again, there will be things happening there, like, you know, Tan will be there, Taylor Marshall will be there, Word on Fire will be there, Ascension Press will be there, like, all of the, like, the sort of Catholic spectrum will be in the metaverse, and then it's just a matter of, like, how people do it. Like, it's not going to not happen.
Right, so what I'm getting at is, like, is that a valid church architecture? Like, is that going to be a valid way for architects such as yourselves to, like, I mean, you could build some, and who's to say if it's real or not real? I mean, it's virtual, but if it's a thing that people go to, and...
The way most people experience most buildings is not in person. Huh? It's already online. It's on, like, ARC Daily emails, it's on Facebook, it's on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok,
right.
However you do it.
I know all about the Lautner House, but I've never been there.
I've never been there.
Right? Just watched the Big Lebowski a couple of weeks ago. I love that thing. Yeah. But, yeah, so, like...
But if it's a means to getting you into an actual, like, corporeal experience with the church...
What is it, though?
That's...
That's the question. Because I think if the Band-Aid is too good, people won't seek out the actual church.
I think that's true. I mean, that's a potential downside. But you have to decide if you're going to be, like, hardcore John Sr. or if you're going to, like...
Are you actively petitioning for building ugly churches in the metaverse? Your one opportunity to build,
I'm saying,
like...
It is inevitable that there will be ugly. Well, no, I mean, there is something really interesting about this because, like, for example, you know, you were mentioning the church in Louisiana. Some of them may have real marble or maybe it was just painted.
Yeah.
So...
Wood,
what's the difference between painted marble and real marble?
If you never touch it, nothing.
Right.
If no one ever touches it and it's a mystery
to
the
metaverse.
Yeah.
If the metaverse
if it never falls off the altar and splinters into termites.
If the metaverse is good enough, does it matter that it's not real? I mean, it's a real question.
Well, theologically, yes. And
theologically,
sacramentally,
yes.
Sacramentally, yes.
But that, I mean, that's the same.
I think it does matter.
It's the whole simulation question. It's like, if the simulation is good enough, does it matter? And if we can't tell, then the question is kind of moot because you can't tell.
But also, the same, I mean, always with an eye towards evangelization, if you can get some young metaverse hipsters into your nice Catholic church in the metaverse, might they actually seek out a real Catholic church in meat space, you know?
Like, correct. I think the only way that is justified is if it leads to a real encounter. Because if it's purely a digital encounter, I don't think that's going to do it. I don't think that's enough. Because, I mean, the whole idea of the incarnation is that it happened in the real world. It wasn't a spiritual thing. Yeah. It was like, it happened in the world. He had flesh, you know, he took on our flesh and he saved us. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It wasn't a purely spiritual thing.
Although technically neither would be the metaverse. I mean, that is it is a different kind of reality, but it is, it exists somewhere on hardware and software, and it is interacted with by flesh and blood people, even if they're not actually flesh and blood sort of in the scenarios that play out there. It's there. I mean,
you have to unplug though. Like, you have to go to the bathroom, and like, you have to, even if you sleep and wake up, and that whole experience of like going through your sort of cycle, you still have to eat, you still have to go to the bathroom, you still have to like breathe, you still probably have to change and bathe. So like, there are some things that, and maybe these are like dumb things that within 10 years people are like, ha ha, you said you had to like flip phone, ha ha, flip phone,
ha ha,
I don't know, touch screens. But like,
ever heard of a catheter?
Well, how long?
I'm not, by the way, a metaverse bull. No. I know I'm coming on strong with it, but like, I'm coming on strong with it for the sake of argument.
The idea of the
metaverse is totally gross to me, and I don't plan to spend much time there. Yeah. But
I think it does remove one of the big.
Yeah, businesses. you're talking about a space where people are, where that is like both visual and tactile, and you know, and everything else, and is devoid of all the like litigious
gravity.
Liability, insurance,
and gravity.
And gravity, right.
I mean
you can build like a, what's that movie? The Fifth Element. Like, you can build stuff out of the Fifth Element.
I love, it's a weird movie. I love The Fifth Element.
Oh, it's
Element.
So good.
So
classic,
good.
Yeah.
I mean, best Bruce Willis movie.
And
maybe
yet,
Monkeys, but
I love the fact that we have to deal with gravity.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
that is architecture.
I will say, let's give the metaverse some props for just a moment. What it could do is it could give you a space for a brief moment as a designer to say, like, the reality right now is that, like, a lot of the world is just not comfortable with where we're at. And I think that's a really good thing. That, like, for a brief moment, we're reminded that we're sojourners and we're not supposed to be comfortable with our 401ks and our, you know, whatevers in life. Like, COVID and, like, global stuff. At the time of this recording, we just pulled out of Afghanistan and, like, it's a hot mess. And, like, things are not great in the world. And while I don't revel in that, what I do, I think, like in reflecting on it is that it's a kind of like the veil has opened a little bit, and we see that what I think is a good thing is that we're not meant to be totally comfortable here because this is not our end. And in the same way, or maybe in a kind of parallel way, in the metaverse, designers can do something that is in some way unencumbered for a moment. And I think I agree with you, Ralph. I think the encumbrances, in a way, make good projects great projects. But if you wanted to speak to some sort of deeper, like, symbolic truth about the faith, you could make anything, and people could be like, that's some crazy shit. Like, where did that come from? And then someone says, like, let me tell you about, like, the meaning behind this thing. And it becomes more like video game design or movie set design and less of, like, architecture. You call it a building, but, like, what does a building mean in a video game? Like, you know, the things that typically define a building are effectively not there at all. Let's say zero of them, other than, like, the idea of spatial, you know, engagement in some way. So I think it's got potential to maybe cue people in that otherwise would not be interested in anything to do with Catholicism or Christianity at all to be like, that's interesting, that's, like, beautiful, that's weird. And you could kind of own that and make that a means of, you know, expressing something of the faith that people can engage with. That could be cool. I totally think that it's a means to an end, and the degree to which it's seen as a place you can just camp out in and never get back to the real world is the degree to which it's just, like, destructive and, like, the ultimate satanic gambit, mm-hmm. where they say, you don't even need your body. The thing that Christ gave you that will be the means of your salvation, that is in some way the thing that suffers most, like, it's the thing that dies, that, like, if you don't have that, then it's really hard to imagine how you could ever, like, salvifically suffer. So mm-hmm. if that's truly separated, then that's, like, the worst possible thing you could probably imagine besides not dying, which is kind of like not dying if your body is just not a thing that you associate with anymore.
Yeah.
But I think that there's still potential there that, like, I have no idea how to wrap my mind right now other than, like, the rules seem to not really be the rules as you knew them. And then you're like, what does that mean? I don't know.
Are you saying that every Latin Mass will be a solemn high Mass in the metaverse? I mean,
that's right.
Will there be any Latin Masses in the metaverse?
Oh, man. Yeah. No, but I mean, it's an interesting provocation because even let's say that in the real world, If we eventually get contact lenses that just alter reality, right? Like augmented reality, right? So you're still going into your run-of-the-mill suburban parish, but it suddenly looks like Shartz.
Yeah. You know? It's all green screen. It's all painted green exactly. on the inside, and you walk in.
And to you, it looks like a Gothic cathedral, and to you, it looks like Romanesque, and to me, it looks like a modern church, because that's what I like.
Right.
That's the worst thing ever.
You know,
and the priest is like in the full body green suit, and so like right. when I see him, he's at Orientum, but when you see him, he's flip facing.
So the altar moves as
sign
well.
Sign me up. No,
that's
but
right, you just key in your preferences, and
but in all seriousness, though, if it's real enough, like the marble that's fake, is it fine? I mean, I think not, no. but. It's still cheap, you know, it's still an imitation, but it's an interesting provocation,
I mean,
for sure.
There's this model, and I'm going to keep on going on this metaverse thing. There's this model of imagining the cycle of someone's relationship to the parish individually that is phrased in a couple of different ways, but the way I've heard it most recently is belong, believe, bless. And the idea behind this is that in order for you to get to the point where you are fully engaged in the church, you have to first feel like you belong. And then once you feel like you belong in the church, then you believe. So you come to, like, you know, understand catechetically and charismatically what the faith teaches and how to live it. And then bless is a kind of, it's the reverse of that, right? You first belong, then you receive the thing, which is believing, and then you bless and you give back. It could be that what the metaverse does is slowly cannibalize the first of those three phases, where you feel like you belong. And you recognize the church as a thing where you identify with yourself. You say, we, by, and that's probably true partly right now on social media, where you see, like, people on, like, you know, Ascension Press or, like, Father Mike Schmitz or Bishop Barron or whoever on Instagram, and you don't know your pastor or anyone in church, but, like, they're your church.
Oh, yeah.
Like, we, the Catholic 100%. Church. So I'll go ahead and just say, oh, I love this. This is so good. All of my favorite quotes are coming to light here. The future is already here. It's just unequally distributed.
Yeah,
that's a Musk quote, which I think he was talking about, I don't know what he's talking about, maybe AI. But let's just say the belong is already digitized. You belong to a digital church. And if it's local church, it's local after it's a digital church. It may just be more sort of totalized in the metaverse. And the believe, maybe like the catechetical part where you like grow an intimacy with Christ is like halfway done with like VR goggles on, who knows? It'd be hard to imagine if all three of these could be done. It can't be done because the sacraments have to be in person, but you can't, like, I don't know. But the idea that part of this sort of
just wait for Vatican
relationship,
III.
Vatican III, no.
Frankly, the metaverse is the only place where Vatican III could actually happen. I've read articles. No, seriously. I've read articles about the possibility of Vatican III and how
no
there have been so many dioceses created since the mid-60s. That, I mean, for Vatican II, there was only a sampling of bishops from around the world.
Yeah.
And it was still enormous. And there's like three or four times the number of dioceses. Whoa, since then.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
So it's going to be a giant
diocese have split into suffragan dioceses. And, I mean, like, there's so many bishops in the world that, I mean, Vatican III would have to be in, like, a European soccer stadium.
It's a Zoom call.
Just but for bishops. Not,
just for bishops, yeah. And that's not even talking about, like, ancillary staff and observers.
Oh, no, yeah,
and
it's blown out.
And everything else. So, I mean, like, if you think about it, the metaverse is the perfect place for Vatican III to happen.
It's about the only place. It's either that or Minecraft. I don't know which one's better.
It's like a Teams, a giant Microsoft Teams meeting or a Zoom call. People are like, can you mute the mic, please? Yeah.
You're muted. You're muted. You're muted, Holy Father.
I had a joke jump right up to the tip of my lips, and then I swallowed it back, and you're better for it. So.
I'll be really sad if that joke didn't make it to see the light.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh.
No, yeah, it's...
Had to do with Tubin.
I'm glad you didn't say it.
Not Tobin, Tubin.
It's...
Oh, man.
Yeah. I mean, it's... It's going to be interesting.
One thing that I am looking back quickly through my notes is that in thinking about what the future of Catholic Church architecture is, it's weird thinking about architecture because it's not the kind of thing where you can say it's like... taking a sample of all the people in the United States, where it's atomized to the individual person, but it's also not like what is the architecture of the federal government, where you can think of like maybe there's a handful of buildings, the White House, the Pentagon, a few other things. It's kind of in this weird middle ground, and it doesn't also happen that often. What I mean by that is there may be a single church for multiple or tens of thousands of people, and that is a kind of not direct one-to-one representation. And these things that are at that scale also don't happen all that often. So when you think what the future is, you have to think of like, well, how often do these things get built? Like, what does the future mean? Well, the future is either metaverse stuff, that, like who knows what the hell that is, or it's buildings that get renovated or built. And how often does this happen? Not all that often. And according to the people on like Facebook that were like, what do you mean church architecture? Like, are we done with that? It's like zero. It's like, no, like there are people still building. But realistically, think about it. New buildings are built in, let's say, the Archdiocese of Galveston, Houston, which is huge. A new church, let's say the last 20 years or 30 years, there have been a lot of new building, but in the next 20 or 30, there may be a handful. Like, there won't be many new buildings. Like, St. Faustina, I know, is going to build a new church soon, hopefully. There are additional chapels. St. Anthony's is building a little chapel right now that I'm helping with. There may be a few other kind of one-offs. Maybe the Ordinary will build something as they grow.
Regina Chaley will bootstrap another real parish church.
Yeah. But most of the parishes that exist right now have their main church built. They're probably not going to build a new one. There probably won't be any new parishes. St. Faustina is the only new parish that's like built out of whole cloth. So when you think of like what it means and how many data points you have, one thing I was just sort of pondering on was that it's in this weird middle ground where we think that there's this trend towards a more traditional expression of the faith. And that takes place really quickly with music because you can hire a new music director. There's an organ there. They're popping out all the stops, literally pulling out all the stops and like, you know, chanting. And you can make the music happen really quickly. But architecturally, it takes time to both have a void to fill or a building that's ready to be demolished, like literally take a wrecking ball to it. So it's kind of hard to say, I think, because of the refresh rate of these new buildings. And if like my church right now is kind of built in the round, but it's not ready to be demolished anytime soon. So even if people want a more traditional building, just like by virtue of like reasonable finances and like the like non-aggressive aesthetic issues the building has, like we've done enough to where it's fine. So it's kind of hard to say, honestly, like what the future will be in a non-tabula rasa. Like, it's not a clean slate, like brand new piece of paper.
Yeah, but I personally think that if you wanted to renovate, I mean, look at St. Teresa's. St. Teresa's in Sugarland. Have you been there?
Oh, yeah.
It's sort of in the round. But they renovated it.
Well, yeah, Father Stephen Reynolds came
That's
in.
That's right.
Who knows a great deal about architecture.
That's right.
Yeah, he's an exception to the rule, for sure.
And he fixed it.
Pimped that house.
Best.
Right?
That's right.
And so what I think is it's possible to do if the will is there and if the funding is there, obviously.
Yeah.
The hard thing to overcome, I think, is the current spirit of the age. I mean, I don't think that like people are just chomping at the bid to put altar rails back in or to build, you know, super traditional sanctuaries. You can do it. You could do it tomorrow. You could start the design process tomorrow if you wanted to.
Yeah.
But I think that we're still having to overcome the big questions. Mm-hmm. What is a Catholic church? Like, what should it look like? Yeah. You know what I mean? So, yes, I understand architecture is slow and it's a slow process and you have to build it and you have to get funding, etc. But I think that's not what's stopping us from doing it.
Yeah.
It's the fact that we're still dealing with the baggage, I guess, of the 60s. We're still dealing with it.
Yeah, I know.
You know, the people who are funding our churches don't want altar rails. They don't want, you know, baldacchinos over the altar.
I mean, I guess
that's what we're really.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. The nuance I would put on it is that I would say that in my church, have you been to St. Thomas More?
I have.
Around the corner? Okay. So I would say that's pretty token, like 60s or 70s architecture.
For sure.
It's like the stained glass, the layout, like on the corner, there was almost, up until very recently, there was no center aisle. Like, it was pretty of its time, let's say.
Of its time.
And of its time.
Yes.
I think that there's probably at least a kind of moderately sized, if not over 50% grouping of people that would like it to be continue to trend more traditional, but outside of like just putting in an altar rail or kneeling rail, communion rail, and like, you know, building a reredos or something, architecturally, like the big moves are done. So
I disagree. I mean, I think you could do a lot in that church. Like, I think you could do a St. Teresa's style remodel of that church and have it be very nice for a long time.
Yeah.
Keep the windows or do away with the windows?
I actually think the windows are the best quality of that space. I mean, the beautiful, like, stained glass windows with all the colors and everything. Sure, they're very abstract and, like, but, I mean, that's kind of the best thing it has going for it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
The longer you sit in there, I think the windows do grow on you. But, like, it, not going to lie, the first time I was in there, it was, like, the first time. The first, like, weeks, an extended amount of time.
At least they have stained
glass. It was just...
Most of the windows in there I have no problem with. But the actual, like, Thomas More and his family...
It's a little too abstract.
They look like... But,
I mean, I understand there's only so much you can do.
Well, but I guess what I'm getting at is there may be parishes where people want to have more traditional expressions of the faith, but... They're just not in a place where they need to knock down the building. I mean, I feel like St. Teresa's is like a little bit heavy-handed, and like it's distracting to me because it's so different from the rest of the building.
I agree. It's a little
movie set.
It looks like a stage set.
It's a little dissonant between the front of the church and the back of the church.
I would rather have
that than something less.
I would rather have that, but like toned down to like 70% volume. Like it's to me, it's just like too distracting. And maybe after a while you get used to it, but I hear what you're saying. There's definitely things you can do. I guess the point I'm trying to make is that there may be people, there may be more people there that want tradition than we think.
Well, but like, for example, here's what I'm getting at. And this, you know, it's controversial perhaps, but it's, if you wanted tomorrow to do a really traditional liturgy at any given parish, like if you wanted to do Ad Orientem with chant, with altar boys only, and like the whole thing, I don't think there's a priest in the diocese who would do it, because people would be up in arms. I mean, they would complain. They would say, like, what are you doing? You're trying to take us back to the pre-Vatican II, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
And I'm not even blaming the priests. It's a difficult position to be in. But I think that, like you said before, liturgy comes before culture, which comes before architecture. If priests are not at liberty to celebrate a really traditional liturgy, then they're sure are not able to do a really traditional renovation of a church. Like, that would be even harder to do because then it's permanent. Now you have Father Reynolds who just said, I really don't care, I'm just going to do it. But not every priest is going to do that. So, I mean, ultimately, until we get to a point where priests are able to take the first step of just celebrating a traditional liturgy, the traditional architecture is not going to be able to follow. I mean, that's really the first step, you know. Because I feel like, you know, whether you want to call it being pastoral or you want to call it the fact that some people are just uncomfortable with how they grew up, I guess, some people just do not want to see anything that even hints at a return to the way things were.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I guess the thing that I would, feel free to jump in, we're kind of like hitting the back off here. The thing that I don't know about is if we can conflate traditional architecture with traditional liturgy so one-to-one. And what I mean by that is, like, it's not just an, you know, an ad orientem mass, but, like, I can imagine a building that is built detailed with traditional motifs, say the classical or whatever, but still is a Novus Ordo building. Mm-hmm. So I can imagine someone doing a traditional renovation that they want the aesthetics of tradition, but they don't, let's say, know how to celebrate an extraordinary form mass. Or what do you call it? Is it still extraordinary form? Did that term get demolished now?
I don't know.
Whatever.
It's up in the air.
Extraordinary form, traditional Latin mass.
Take your pick.
Whatever.
Yeah.
We're in 2021. Who knows what things are these days?
The outlaw mass.
The outlaw. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think, let me back up just a second. I think people...
Before, so you think there's a difference between a traditional liturgy and a traditionally outfitted building?
Yeah. I mean, I think you can have a building where the parish celebrates a typical Novus Ordo mass, and it looks like a traditional
Whatever
church.
That means, because yeah. Who knows what that means.
Yeah, I'm just going to say it. and it looks like a traditional building. Like, it looks like a church.
Yeah.
I think people want buildings that look like churches. When I say I do church architecture, I'm a church architect, they say, oh, what happened? Why don't the things look like they used to? Yeah. Like, ah, crap. Like, are you helping or are you hurting? That's like the question.
Yeah.
And everyone wants churches to look like churches. Like, I have not met a single person who's like, oh, church architect, great. You do things in the round? Like, not that that's synonymous with all of the things that are terrible about things that have happened since the 60s, but no one begins a conversation by, like, giving me an attaboy because we're, you know, enacting the spirit of Vatican II. Everyone says, please, dear God, save our buildings. You know? It's like, that's the only thing I ever hear.
Yeah, I think, yeah, I mean, and obviously this is where we're having this conversation. I do think there is a very close connection between liturgy and architecture. Mm-hmm. I do think that it's not a coincidence that churches before the Second Vatican Council looked the way they did.
Yeah, no, I agree.
You know, I think agree. There is a correlation between the two. Now, however, that does not mean that new churches can't look traditional and you can still have the priests face the people and yeah. have sound systems and screens and all kinds of things. But I do think there's a correlation.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, no, I definitely
think it's a strong correlation. It's not just a kind of incidental.
Yeah, I would not go so far as to say causal, but I totally agree. I think there's a
I would say it's causal. I mean, I do think, again, it's not a coincidence. I don't think, because here's the thing. Here's what I'm, as far as the future of church architecture, here's what I'm afraid of. This return to tradition is a fad that is going to go away. So we are going to have a pendulum swing to tradition. And in fact, Father Reynolds even told me this one time. I had a conversation with him. And he said, you know all the stuff I did in St. Teresa's? It'll be whitewashed eventually. You know, that we are witnessing a pendulum swing back to tradition. But then the pendulum will swing right back to whitewashing, you know.
Yeah.
And I personally hope that that's not the case, that this is hopefully a deeper conversion that we're witnessing that will have a change in liturgy. Because if it's just currently priests think that tradition is cute and they want to sing chant and do some other things, fine, that's good, but we're just going to go right back. The pendulum will once again swing the other way.
Do you think any of them think that?
Well, not currently, because they're living in it. But my fear is that if it's not deeper, if, in other words, if the liturgy itself doesn't come along with it, and it's just like, well, we seem to like the more traditional trappings, but the liturgy is the same, then it can easily swing back the other way and the trappings will change and will continue.
What are the difference between trappings and the liturgy? You're drawing a distinction that I'm not quite sure.
That there are, you know, like, for example, like worshiping towards the east, ad orientem, you know, that the fact that there is a connection between that and the way churches used to be built, right? Mm-hmm. That there is the idea that, for example, like you were saying, that chant is not optional, that there is something about it that is inherently part of liturgy, that you can't just decide, you know what, you like chant, but I like folk music, so I'm going to do folk music. But no, there's an integrity to the liturgy that we can't just mess with. You know, it's not just a CD that you're popping in and seeing, you know, you like rock music and you like something else, but that there's an integrity to it that can't be messed with. Mm. That's what I'm talking about, you know, like, and that in the architecture itself, there's an integrity that can't just be fiddled with, and, you know, that with the passing of time, fads will come and go, but that there is something that endures through it all. You know, like if you look at Gothic to Renaissance to Baroque to et cetera, you know, even all the way up to you know, the Art Deco that I know you're familiar with, you know, the Art Deco architecture, there are parts of those churches that were all the same. You know, like there's a thread that you can look at and say, this didn't change.
Right. That is the 2 points on a line with the infinite variation between he was talking about before. Like, you walk into that Art Deco church in Chicago that we're both familiar with. What is it, St. Peter? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you walk into that church and you walk into, you know, Renaissance era church, and everything, all the decoration looks different, but all the stuff's in the same place.
Right.
You know?
Yes, there is a stability that that then the creativity can happen around. Mm. You know, like you can have a lot of creativity, but there's a certain essence that doesn't change, you know. So that's what I'm talking about. It's just that there does seem to be a connection between the two. And it doesn't mean that, you know, that liturgy itself can't develop, but it does mean that there's a stability to it that, you know, isn't up to the whim of whoever is celebrating, but that it kind of is bigger than any one person. You know? So that's kind of where I'm coming from.
Yeah. I'm hoping these mics actually pick up this recording, that we're not. It's the first time we're using these new mics for all those people who are listening out in podcast land.
I know.
And if we're not recording, then you'll never hear this. So. Yeah.
But, you know, Maybe to close out, talking about Art Deco and all that, you know, to me, one of the most interesting periods in church architecture was right at the turn of the century, right coming into the 20th century. Some of the most interesting church architecture experiments were being done, because you were all of a sudden getting access to all of this new technology. There was steel, there was concrete, there was, you know, a lot of the modern movement. And so a lot of people were experimenting, but you still had the kind of baseline of the liturgy that you didn't have to mess with. Yeah. I think where things began to go off the rails is the moment everything is up for grabs, then, I mean, who knows what's going on?
Oh, yeah. You know what I mean? There's definitely...
I mean, that's when things go off the rock.
Yeah, I mean, speaking from personal experience, the times in grad school and even undergrad, the projects that were most successful were the ones where I had established a rule that I never broke.
Yeah.
And where the rule was a good rule, it was even better. There was a time where I had done like, it was the first studio. We had this little folly behind the build, little like space thing. It was just like, align these planes. And the first thing I did was like grid, where it was like 5x5x5 grid.
Yeah.
And then I had these planes and I just kind of made this composition. And in the end, the professor was like, "This is really good." And I was like, "Oh, it must be amazing." And then in the end, it was just like, I like had this dumb rule where it was like 5x5 grid, like in a cube, and all these things aligned. And it was like the rule was the design. Everything else was just like whatever. So you're saying like that's the rule was like, let's say the liturgy of my Studio 101 project.
Yeah, exactly.
And I like did whatever inside of it. It didn't matter what I did because the parameters that were set from the very beginning were what made it
exactly
internally coherent.
Yeah.
The things always synced up on a grid line. And there are other projects where it's almost like I could probably look back actually and reanalyze all my projects based on the success of the fences I built around the playground.
Absolutely.
And what I did in the playground honestly doesn't matter. It's like the shape of the fence is the project.
Is what created the gave you the parameters to create. And I don't know if you know, if in your line of work, in your art, you kind of think about it that way as well. But, I mean, in some ways, you are just because of the nature of what you do. And maybe you can explain it here in a minute. But same thing with me. I mean, part of what makes architecture so interesting is that you're having to deal with the real world, with gravity. And your ability to define the parameters is almost a project. You know, like, more so than just how creative can I be. It's like, how well do you understand what you're working with? If you can understand that well, then you're gonna create something really cool.
Yeah.
If you ignore what's there, if you don't create good parameters, you'll actually create something that is completely irrelevant to what's happening.
Yeah.
You know. So I don't know if you kind of deal with that with pottery.
We should just say, Rafa and I, and I'm always like, are people watching or listening? I don't know. Chris and Rafa are architects. We design and build buildings. Ryan is not. So Ryan has been commenting as a kind of like insider outsider, but
a
Ryan
dilettante,
is
a, I think, is the word.
Dilettante.
Yes.
What is it? Is it ceramicist? Potter? What do you? What do you refer to?
Man, I don't even know what I am anymore. You know, Potter. I'm a stay-at-home dad.
You're that's the Potterfamilias.
That's right.
Potterfamilias.
A stay-at-home dad. That's all I am. No.
What a potter you are.
That's true. I do make pots from time to time. And yes, in I mean the success of any thing you're going to make is twofold. It's, you know, does it do the job it's prescribed to do? For instance, if it's a coffee mug, like, does it have the same basic proportions as most coffee mugs, and does it not weigh like 5 pounds? You know, like, is it the right weight, has roughly the right volume? And then beyond that rule, you know, that's the rule you give yourself. Yeah, like it should hold roughly, you know, 8 ounces of liquid, and you shouldn't have to like do a bicep curl to lift it to your face. And then beyond that, there's infinite variations from type of clay to decoration to glaze to firing temperature. I mean, there's a million different ways you can do it. And so, yeah, I would say the same thing applies in pottery as in anything. And, you know, what you're really... for pottery, it's a twofold thing that you're designing. You're designing the interior space of the thing, which is the useful part, and then you're designing the outside of it, which, you know, in old folk pottery, I mean, half of it's not even adorned at all. It's completely just useful. Like you dip, you run the glaze on the inside because that's where the food is going to come in contact with. And then you dip just enough of the outside of it in glaze to where anywhere that food or drink might sort of get on
covered.
The, but then the rest of it, you don't bother because it's not necessary. It's not necessary. And
oh, that's the art.
And the same with Roman pottery. Like, we just, we actually just went to the Natural Science Museum a couple of weeks ago and saw the Pompeii exhibit. Mm. And there's a lot of pottery in that exhibit, and the pottery there is great because it's just...
I've been to Pompeii before.
It's completely...
That's very cool.
...unadorned. Like, it's just, it's like French peasant wear, you know, it's just... It's there to do a job. It's not there to look. It's completely disposable, almost the way you might think of like ball jars in your house. You know, like they're useful for storing things, for canning things. But if you drop one on the floor, there's no artistry to it really. I mean, this is not.
That's funny because like they had running water. They had like, I mean, it was the problem because the pipes were made of lead, but they had like, you know, plumbing in the houses.
Yeah. Well, and no, I don't know.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So for the record, Chris, would you ever design a church in the round under the right circumstances?
If it were a monastery and it were an oval and it were antiphonal seating and I could justify that really long ellipse, yes. Where if it were a parish church in the round, I would have like a long conversation about why.
Well, I mean, to me, the biggest thing is just, is it clear where the altar is? Is it clear where the focus of the whole church is?
Where do I look when I'm genuflecting?
Where do I look when I'm genuflecting? If that is clear, very clear architecturally, we can make a church in the round work.
Yeah.
Would you design a church in the metaverse?
Good question. Sure.
Hard yes.
Why not?
Hard yes.
Yeah, of course.
Try it out, you know? Make something crazy because there's no gravity.
I mean, I look at that as a perfect opportunity.
I mean, I design churches in Minecraft.
I mean, honestly, well, that's the thing. I mean, you design churches on the computer anyway, so the idea of designing one that is inhabitable in 3D, I mean, that's to me that seems like the future of like walking your client through their future church. Like you build it in the metaverse and then you guys go walk through it.
Yeah.
And they're like, couldn't we do something like this over here? And you're like, no. That would look like crap. And you're like, hang on a second. You punch in a few things and all of a sudden what they ask for appears in the metaverse. And they're like, oh, yeah, I see. Okay, that's get rid of that.
But what's probably going to happen is like we're going to have these very elaborately prescribed rules for what the building will look like. So part of how you can think about architecture right now is that we don't design buildings. We manipulate data sets, and the buildings come about from these data sets. And I think that's already the case to a certain degree, because when I think about how Rafa and I will be tasked with, say, designing a building, one of the things we'll be doing is drawing parts of the building. We'll draw a floor plan, we'll draw a section of the building, we'll draw a roof plan. And when we do these things, we no longer do them how we used to do them, which was the digital analog of pen to paper, where you used to, with AutoCAD, you would draw. You would say point, point, line. Now what we do is we say, the wall is made of these things, it's this thick. The wall goes from here to here. And if you want to draw a section, you say the section goes in this location. And then all the elements display themselves, mostly. I mean, you have to like fill in some things, but you're more or less defining parameters of the building system, and the drawings, you don't draw anymore. You create a view of the building, or you create a section through the building that will show you what's there.
So we're already building in the metaverse.
We're already, yeah, I think the future is already
like
here.
If we showed you the software we're already using, you'd be like, that is the metaverse.
Yeah.
Like so, if you wanted to tomorrow to walk through Cathedral High School at Walsh,
you could totally do it.
I could walk you through it. I mean, we're already there. It's just a matter of linking it to the metaverse so others could look at it. You know, I mean, that's where we are.
Yeah. So I think that connection is far closer than we imagine, and we're already operating in a way that's, I think, down the line away from, let's say, not just architecture as it was, but in the computer, but it's very, very far along.
Yeah.
I mean, we could more or less take our buildings we've been creating in order to build them in the real world, and take the digital asset and probably have to, like, you know, deal with texturing and things like that. But we could very quickly get at least the geometry and something like that into a digital environment and just, like, I mean, you could use the the Unity plugin where you go into the 3D environment and you walk around it, but the default character has a gun. So, like, if you want to show your client the building, you have to like go in and turn off the gun, or else you're walking through it where you're like, because it's a gaming platform, so you're. I got a buddy who like forgot to turn it off. And he was like walking through and it's like shooting tennis balls. He's like showing the client residential models and stuff. Yeah, I mean, we're already very far down the line. So I think that people I'd be surprised if we don't have to deal with it at some point in our practice. People that are like the generation beneath us that say are in school right now, if we're like 10 years out of it or something, they're absolutely going to have, you know, that to deal with for most of their career. So
yeah, I mean, I remember I worked for a big company who they were already thinking about the future of architecture as being completely digital. Like that, we would be designing buildings that were not physical. So, I mean, it's coming. I mean, it's definitely coming, and I think there will be whole firms dedicated to building the metaverse physically.
I wonder how the economics of that works, yeah. Like, or how different that is from typical architecture practices.
I hope we make more money. That's what I hope. If it's more lucrative, then we'll make it easier.
I hope my money becomes less of a mammon than it currently is. Then it don't matter how much it is.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. This was great.
Hey, let's cheers. Uh-oh. No one can see our glasses.
Cheers to my empty
filler up.
Fill us up for the final toast.
That's right. I like that we can officially, and not lie when we say it, put metaverse in the title. The future of Catholic Church architecture.
Clearly involves the metaverse.
Metaverse?
Big question mark. I would say, you know, the church started in the catacombs. With any luck, that's where we'll end up.
God willing.
Amen.
Thanks for listening. The best way to enjoy the podcast is to pull up the accompanying blog post for the episode at beautyevernew.com. There you will find show notes, guest information, helpful visual aids, and more. To continue the conversation, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and let us know how you're experiencing beauty in your churches and communities.